So let's consider problem 22. All right. So in this case, you have a voltage, which is V of t times 40 volts. All right. This is V max, what we call V max. And then sine omega t. And this, well, sorry, sine of 100 t, where this is omega, or the angular frequency. Okay? And by the way, on the quiz, although I didn't take off for it, I asked for frequency, not angular frequency. And I think most of you guys got it fine, but some of you calculated the frequency, which was a different, you know, by a ratio by a factor of over 2 pi. So you just want to be careful there. So angular frequency and frequency are different. But okay, so this is a function that we're given. And we also know that the inductance, this is an RLC circuit, has an inductance of 160 millihenries, a capacitance of 99 microfarads, and a resistance of 68 ohms. Okay? Now, the first question, part A, is what is the impedance? Okay? So the impedance, remember, is this quantity that is some estimate of how much this circuit, this RLC circuit, is going to resist the flow of current. And we saw that we could calculate this, so with the symbol Z, which is defined to be R squared plus the difference between the inductive reactance and the capacitive reactance. Okay? And we, since we know R, we need to ask the question, do we know these two reactances? All right? So the inductive reactance is omega L. Now we know omega and we know L, so we can calculate that. And the capacitive reactance is 1 over omega C. And we know omega and we know C. So we can calculate this. So we can rewrite this as omega L minus 1 over omega C. Okay? And I won't go through, then it becomes arithmetic. But if you plug in R, omega, L, and C, what you get is 108.9 ohms. So it has the units of ohms. That's a cross-check. But basically, this is telling you what, for the whole circuit, what the resistance, essentially, we call it impedance because it's a more general term, of that circuit is to the flow of current in it. Okay? All right. Now, I also want to know what's the maximum current. Okay? So here, we know the impedance now. And we can use the sort of, you could say, the generalized form of Ohm's law to figure this one out. So the maximum current is going to equal the maximum voltage divided by the impedance. Okay? And so we have our maximum voltage here. And we just calculated our impedance. So again, if I plug those two in, I'll just write it out. I have 40 volts, 108.9 ohms. So here I will get 0.37 amps. Okay? So oftentimes people will get confused about maximum voltage, maximum current, RMS voltage, and RMS current. Okay? Please keep those straight. When they're asking for the maximum current, we're referring to the amplitude of this sinusoidal function. The amplitude is this number. This is not VRMS. This is Vmax. Okay? VRMS would be if I took the average of this function over time. Okay? Okay, so this is how you... So in the case of calculating the maximum, it's straightforward. We have the maximum voltage. We now have the impedance. We're all set. Okay? Now, the next question is, what's the phase between the current and the voltage? Now, again, when we went through the RLC circuit, what we saw is that, and before that, capacitive inductive circuits, we saw that the reactance from the inductor or capacitor causes a delay, or the opposite of a delay, the preceding of the current with the voltage. Okay? Meaning that the current and the voltage will want to be out of sync for those, for capacitors and inductors. And so there's a cumulative effect in an RLC circuit, which gives a net phase of the current in the circuit with the voltage in the circuit. Okay, so there's going to be some function which is going to look like this. Okay, and this thing is related to this function here. So we just calculated I max. We already know omega. So we want to know what phi is. We want to know what the phase of that current with respect to the voltage is. Okay? So to do that, when we looked at the geometry, the phasor diagram, what we saw was that you could calculate this as the difference between the reactances divided by the resistance, because these two were anti-parallel to each other, and they're on the phasor diagram, these two are perpendicular to the R, the component that's coming from R. Okay? So when we think about this in the phasor diagram, that's where the arctangent comes from. Okay? Again, we know how to calculate these two reactances as omega L and omega C respectively. And so I can substitute that in, and I'll do part of it explicitly. So omega L is 16 ohms. And omega C is 101 ohms, at least by my doing it. And so then I can take the arctangent of this, and what we get is minus 0.896 radians. Okay, so this is now the phi in this sinusoidal function that describes the current. Okay, so, you know, if we think of 90 degrees equals pi over 2, which is approximately 1.57 radians, so you see that this is a little more than half. It's a little more than pi over 4, okay, in terms of radians. Okay? All right, and that's about it. So if we wanted to now write this thing out, then we have all the information that we wanted. So so we know the maximum current, and we know the max and the phase, and so that thing can be compared directly to this. Okay? I wanted to go through that because, first of all, the issue with the Imax, you know, this is the maximum current. Please remember that there's a relationship between the RMS and the maximum. And this just comes about because any sinusoidal function, I mean, I max is just the amplitude of this function. Any sinusoidal function or cosine function has a average of 1 over the square root of 2. Okay? An RMS meaning the an average would be, obviously it goes plus and minus, so the average is 0. But we're talking about the average of the size or of the amplitude. So it's like we take the absolute value and then we calculate the average of that. Okay? We only care about the magnitude. We don't care about the sign in these things. So that's where, that's why we call it the root mean squared, and that's where the square root of 2 comes from. Okay? So please keep track of the difference between those two things. Let's go to something maybe a little more fun. We talked about radios a little bit, and I want to just come back to that for a moment and be a little more clear about what's happening. So we've been talking about RLC circuits, and we've talked about resonance, okay? And we've talked about these RLC circuits in the case where I plug that thing into an AC circuit that has a variation, and then it becomes a filter the way that we talked about it. But let's talk about a circuit. This is a very crude diagram, but let's talk about the following circuit. Okay? So we have an inductor, a capacitor, and a resistor. This is just some big, long loop of wire that just sticks out in space. All right? So this is an antenna. Okay? Now, why did we do this big loop? Well, we did this big loop because what's going to happen is I'm going to have a radio transmitter somewhere, and we're going to talk about how this happens later, but I'm going to have a radio transmitter somewhere, and it's going to generate oscillating electric and magnetic fields. Okay? All right? So these fields are going to be oscillating. They're going to have some angular frequency, omega, and they're going to pass by this conducting loop. All right? Now, what happens when these oscillating waves, these oscillating fields pass by this wave, what happens to this circuit? Does somebody want to say? A little louder, sorry. That's right. So you're going to get it. What's going to happen is you're going to induce a current in this wire, which means in the whole circuit. Okay? So we have a current here that wants to get induced because of this field. But now we've loaded it down with the capacitor, the inductor, and the resistor. And what we've already found is that we don't get, there's no current in an RLC circuit unless omega is somewhere around the natural frequency defined by the L and C components. Okay? This was this thing that we drew, the current in the circuit. So when the frequency of these oscillations is around the natural frequency, so this ratio is 1, then we get a big spike in current. Otherwise, if we're much lower than that frequency or much higher than that frequency, we get nothing. Okay?
What does that say down there at the bottom? Omega?
Yeah, sorry. So this is omega, meaning the frequency of these field oscillations, divided by, I drew this before, so sorry, I was being a little and divided by the natural frequency, which is 1 over LC. Okay? So when this ratio is 1.0, meaning that omega of the oscillations is similar to the natural frequency, then you this is just a graphical representation of this statement. Okay? So, okay, great. So what happens here is that when we, well, hold on. That's fine. But so I have a circuit here. If this frequency is such that it doesn't match here, I don't get any current. That's kind of lame. So what do we do? Well, I'll show you a couple of things that we had before. What we can do is we can take this capacitor, we can actually make a variable capacitor. So if we take this butterfly capacitor, this is a huge version, but it's related to essentially what one would do. This is these are several plates, so it's sort of like a compound capacitor. And by turning the knob, and this is just the knob, the tuner knob on your tuner, by tuning the knob, basically I can change the amount of overlap of these plates. And by doing that, I change the capacitance. Now there's a range over which I can do this, and so there's a range over which I can change the capacitance, and therefore I can vary the natural frequency of this receiver. Okay? And if I vary this, so, so I can do that adjustment, all right? And what I can do is somewhere in here, I can connect this thing to a speaker. There's other electronics, amplifiers, filters, get rid of noise, all this stuff. Can be quite elaborate, but basically I've got a current here. If I plug this thing into a speaker, all right, when there is a real current that passes through this circuit, I can get sound. I can get enough current through this speaker to drive it. Okay? Now, again, there's many pieces that would go in normal stereo system for this, but that's the basic idea. So as I'm adjusting that, basically, if I have my Precambrian radio here, I don't even think this realistic is in business anymore. You know, I can change the capacitance. This is all I'm doing. Okay?
Thank you.
So, and we talked about the width of this thing. Obviously, these frequencies, I mean, you can't see it, but I'm barely moving this thing. And I'm my transmission of the power from that current is going down very rapidly. So this is very, very narrow. Okay, so that's one of the design elements that you want. You want to come up with a resistance that causes this thing to become very narrow. So instead of being like I drew it, you might have something that would look like this. Okay? But it's a basic idea. Okay? You might, some AM radios kind of have wide things, and sometimes you'll notice that you can hear two radio stations at one time. That's because you're actually sensitive enough. You might be on one station, but you're getting spillover from a nearby station because this Q value is too wide. Okay? So that's a radio. We could actually think about this from the point of view of an AM radio. And we could say, well, let's say that we have an inductor, so this is actually problem 38, okay? But let's say we have an inductor of 0.2 millihenries, and we have a variable capacitor. All right? And the question is, this is AM, so we need to be sensitive to 500 kilohertz to 1650 kilohertz. And the question is, what is the capacitor in this circuit that would permit us to have that sensitivity? Okay? Well, this is the function that matters, because when we're near the natural frequency, we have the sensitivity. When we're far from it, we don't. So first we need to calculate what these are frequencies. We need to know the angular frequencies. So in general, we know that omega equals 2 pi f. So I won't go through it, but if I plug these numbers into here, what I get is my angular frequency range is 3,500 rads per second to 10 kilorad radians. I don't mean rad as in radiation rad. So 3,500 to 10,000 rads radians. So that's the frequency of angular frequency range that I need to cover. And so now, since I know this, okay, I could just go at these two endpoints and figure it out. So basically, I can take this and convert it algebraically to LC equals 1 over omega natural squared. And then I got C equals 1 over L omega squared. Okay, so once I have this, my capacitance that corresponds to the low frequency is going to be equal to 0.2 times 10 to the minus 3 henries times 3,500 radians per second squared. And I take the inverse of that. And this gives me 408 microfarads. And I won't, if I do the same calculation, I have the same inductance, but instead of 3,500 radians, I'll have the 10,000. And that's going to give me 50 microfarads. So what this tells me is I need capacitors. I need the ability in my variable capacitor to go from 50 microfarads to 400 microfarads. Okay? So that's a radio. Okay? It's basically what we're doing. Does anybody have a question about that? No? All right. So let me, with some trepidation, let me see if I can entertain you for a moment. Okay, so let's come back to this thing. This is actually just a illustration of induction by a couple different ways. So as I mentioned, we have 1200, we have 60 hertz coming in from the wall. It's 120 volts RMS. All right, but that's not enough. What we want to do is we want to create what's called a Tesla coil. And the reason is we want to have a high field so that we can get sort of electron streamers. It's like creating lightning, okay? But that's a dangerous thing to do. So what we need to do is we need to chop off. If we just did that, I would electrocute myself. That would be bad. So what we need to do is take off, at least I think that would be bad. But we need to chop off the voltage at a much higher frequency, so it doesn't have a long enough time at a particular current. And the issue here is that if the frequency is small enough, or the duration of the current is small enough, the current can't penetrate my body because I'm going to put myself into this circuit. So that's the part that scares me, because I have to trust that whoever designed this thing in 1776 knew what they were doing. So, okay. So and we talked about we have the inductor here, the capacitor here, the resistor here, okay, they're all connected, and we have our that's the transformer. And then we have our inductor here. Now there's one other aspect to this. So the question is, the inductor is an inductor, so it's going to create a magnetic field. So I actually haven't demonstrated to you yet in this class that a magnetic field actually was generated. So I'm going to try to demonstrate that to you in two ways. One is, if I've got a magnetic field generated here, it's going to be varying. I should be able to induce an electric field in this neon light bulb by just holding it in my hand. Okay? And again, if you saw the Prestige, they did kind of a cool thing of that. But the other thing is, if I've generated a magnetic field coming out of this coil, then I should get eddy currents in this metal ball. And if I get those currents there, I got electrons moving around, I should be able to pull a few of them off by holding this conductor here. Of course, they're going to go through me to the ground, so that's why we need to cut this off, so it only travels through my skin. Okay? So, and the last time I did this, I did shock myself. It really was not fun. So I will learn my lesson and take my ring off. Don't tell my wife. Okay. I'm not going to flinch. Where are the lights here? They're probably all computer controlled, so I can't do anything about them. There's no way I can. Can you see the flickering? No? So that's one piece of evidence that we have induced a magnetic field. The other piece is this thing. So now, because this thing is small, a pretty strong magnetic field electric field will be generated at the surface of this ball because all the charge is going to be concentrated. So if I bring this thing here, again, it's just like lightning. It's going to want to come. This also is sharp. It's going to want to come to here. Okay. So. I've induced it. An electric field inside this thing. Now, so what else can I say about that? So there was something else I wanted to say about it. I told you about how it was not going to electrocute me, and it didn't, thank God. It really did hurt the last time. Okay, first of all, did I not flinch? There's evidence that I didn't flinch. Can I brag to Richard?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I know what it was. It's just when they gave me this thing, they said, "Oh, do this demo," and I was like, "Yeah, right." So what I did is I went on the web and I tried to research about Tesla coils. There are some very strange people on the internet. If you go out there and just Google Tesla coils, you can find out there's web pages on how to do this, and some of them are hysterical. They're like, "Well, how big do you want your streamers to be? Do you want them to fill your garage? Here, this is how you build one." I don't know, if you do it right, it could be safe. I wouldn't recommend building a garage-sized Tesla coil, though. Okay, so that's basically that. Let me turn this off. Okay, now we're almost done now with basically circuits. The last thing I want to tell you, very, very basic stuff, just to finish off. There's three concepts that are at the end of the chapter, so I'll be very quick about them because I want to get on with things. We talked about mutual inductance, okay? And one way to talk about mutual inductance is we talked before when we had two coils that were overlapping. So the magnetic field from one was basically creating, inducing a current in the other. Okay, but we can also separate these two things by a little bit and put an iron, essentially, rectangle. And what this is this causes the magnetic field lines generated by this coil to follow this and get brought over to here. And you can't really see it very well, but that's exactly what this thing is. These are two separated coils. Well, actually, maybe you can see it. Here's a coil, and here's a coil. Okay? And here's the iron. It's exactly what I just drew, actually. Okay? So what we're doing... oh, man, I really screwed up. The transformer here, these things can cause an increase in voltage and a decrease. To get the streamer, I needed to create a lot of field. 120 volts out of the wall can't do that. So that's why we use a transformer, because by changing, I have some number of loops here, N1, and some number of loops here, N2, okay? And if N2 is much larger than N1, I can get an increase in voltage, okay? So let me just do that for a moment. If we think about in circuit 1 from Faraday's law, we have this, okay? V1 equals negative N1 d phi dt. For loop 2, we have V2 equals negative N2 d phi dt. Okay, now the d phi dt is the same in both cases, so it's getting generated here and being brought to here. Okay, and what we can say is that I can figure out, if I know this voltage and the fact that these two are the same, I can basically calculate V2 as a function of V1. It will be this. Okay? So V2 equals V1 times the ratio of the number of turns in the two coils. So if N2, let's say that N2 equals 60 times N1, which is the case in this transformer, okay? At least that's what the piece of paper I have tells me. Then what it means is if this, and I plug that into this function, this is 120 volts. That means this is going to be around 10,000 volts. Okay? So the voltage that I'm creating through here is 10,000 volts in this circuit. Okay? And, of course, I've changed the frequency from 60 hertz with this chopper. I should have explained that when I did that before. Okay, so if N2 is greater than N1, this is called a step-up transformer. If N2 is less than N1, it's called a step-down transformer. Okay? Why does this matter? The reason that it matters, and this is key for power distribution, here you have a power system. Okay, a power plant. Well, the problem is they've got to transmit that power to your house. It's many miles of copper wire. And that copper wire has a little bit of resistance. So you lose power as I squared times R. Okay? Which means that if I've got a little bit of a resistance, but I've got a high current, I'm going to get a very big loss in power. I'm going to lose a lot of power that I generated. So what you want to do is you want to step up the voltage that gets sent out of the power plant so that the current is very small. And when the current is very small, this means that the power losses, because of this square, are small in the wires. And then when you get to your house, or near it, some blocks from your house, you step it back down to 120. Okay? And then the current goes up, but it doesn't have to travel very far in the cables, and so you don't lose a lot of power. So this is how power is distributed. You basically step up the voltage, out of the power, you know, it's generated at some modest voltage like 480 or 120 or whatever, but then out of the power plant you step it up to thousands of volts or even more, and then when you get near where it's going to be delivered to the homes, you step it back down to 120, and by doing this, you've avoided losing a lot of the power you generated in the transmission lines. Yes? V1 is the amplitude of that AC voltage. And V2 would be, you know, there will be an induced AC voltage in that circuit, which will be V2. Okay?